I went outside and I said, please hurry. They think that Steve is dead.
He was a good guy. He was very loyal, very good friends. I mean, well, I considered us, you know, brothers.
Fire becomes a way of obliterating a person from existence.
A lot of murders occur as a result of uncontrolled passions, love triangles, jealousy, revenge.
This is becoming much, much more complex. We started to ask different questions.
A shocking murder becomes a dark mystery. The victim's body holds the key to convicting the killer. Every fiber is a clue. Every wound is a piece of the puzzle. In these cases, it's up to the medical examiner to find the crucial evidence and catch the murderer. This is Secrets of the Morgue.
When you drive across the Bay Bridge and start just feeling the atmosphere of being on the Eastern Shore, you don't ever want to leave. And it has a way of taking hold of you and keeping you.
St. Michael's is a quaint historic town on the eastern shore of Chesapeake Bay. On its outskirts, Harbor Town Resort. It's the ideal spot for a secluded, romantic getaway.
People just go there to hang out by the water, you know, watch the sunrise and sunset. Just a beautiful place to relax and enjoy time with a loved one.
But on Valentine's Day weekend, 1998, the romantic mood at Harbortown Resort is suddenly interrupted.
A woman reports that her room is on fire.
Kimberly Rico is frantic. Her husband, Stephen, is trapped in the blaze.
Hotel personnel were able to force their way into the room. Smoke was billowing out. They locate Stephen Rico. They pulled him out of the room. And then a few minutes later, the rescue personnel arrived. He was deceased, however.
Stephen Rico was just 35 years old.
But it looked like he was sleeping in bed or had fallen asleep next to the bed, you know, while smoking. There were some beer bottles on a nightstand. There was a pornographic-type magazine there on the floor. There was a package of cigars with one missing.
He dropped his cigar, place goes up in flames. It really looked like a tragic fire accident.
Everyone felt for the couple, felt for the family.
Kim Rico has just lost her husband of 9 years and the father to their young daughter.
Steve was like a big teddy bear. On the outside, he was this gruff and muscular kind of guy. But inside, he had a heart of gold and would run through a brick wall for anybody he cared about.
I met Steve when we were in seventh grade, junior high school. Played football and basketball together and just kind of hit off as good friends.
My husband and I introduced Steve and Kim and they hit it off from day one. My husband and Steve were best friends and Kim and I were best friends. So we spent a lot of time together. It was just like a big happy family. When we got the call that Steve is dead, that the fire killed him, We got in the truck and left immediately so I could go take care of Kim. It was the longest drive in the world. I got to Harbortown. I walk in the room and Kim is sitting with her brother and she has her hands, you know, wrapped around her face. And she was crying. I just couldn't think about what was going through Kim's mind. I felt terrible for her.
Stephen's badly burned body is sent to forensic pathologist Dr. David Fowler for autopsy.
Typically here in Maryland, the autopsy is performed within 24 hours.
This case appeared to be a relatively simple case. And so therefore, my initial response to this one is that I'll be able to do some fairly simple blood tests, fill out the report, and be able to certify the death to the standard required.
The relationship between the investigators and the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner here in Maryland is very close. They depend on us for a thorough, competent investigation on our end, and we rely on the same for them.
As Dr. Fowler begins the autopsy, detectives interview the hotel staff and guests.
In interviewing people who actually pulled Stephen out, he was backed up against the bed, seated on the ground with his legs extending out from him. And part of the bed was burned, and his upper torso was burned, but his lower body was not burned.
So the first thing that we do is look at the circumstances in which the body was found. There was a significant amount of charring over the upper portion of his body. When you talk about charring, you're talking about fourth degree, which is something most people don't see in living human beings. Typically, we talk about first degree, which is reddening of the skin, second degree, which is blistering, third degree, which is the skin beginning to peel off, and then fourth degree when you have charring. So he had all of those.
In a body that's been badly burned, the challenge is on the initial external examination. You're not really sure what you're looking at. You have no idea, oftentimes, if there are injuries on the outside of the body. And if you're not careful and don't have a heightened level of suspicion, you may miss those injuries initially.
Investigators need to find out more about what really happened to Stephen. They start by questioning his wife.
Kimberly said that their marriage was struggling. She said they came down to Harbortown to try to salvage their marriage.
Kim tells investigators that her husband had been drinking heavily that night.
Where she said that he got back to the room, that he wanted to have sex. That this was supposed to be a no-sex weekend where they would just talk and communicate. They got in an argument. Kimberly got mad, and she left.
Kim stormed out and drove off into the cold, dark night.
And when she came back to the room, she went to open the door and she noticed smoke. So she ran to the front desk. They called the local fire department and went back to the room, pulled Stephen out, and he was dead.
The first thing that sprung to mind was the toxic fumes from a fire. They get into their bloodstream, and we can find those by very simple tests in the toxicology laboratory. I ask for a rapid carbon monoxide assessment, which I got back in about half an hour, and it was negative. It was a bit of a surprise.
Dr. Fowler must now find another way that the fire could have killed Stephen.
So I thought, well, looking at these photographs, so I can see a lot of soot on the walls, or soot on the ceiling. Let me do an autopsy. I'm going to find soot in the upper and lower airway and down into his lungs. And that will confirm that he was inhaling the products of combustion. I was confident that I would see that soot in his airway. Until I opened up the lungs and there was no soot in his airway. At this stage, that was very surprising. I have somebody with no carbon monoxide in their bloodstream. So I have no toxicological evidence of exposure to the fire. And now I'm not seeing the soot, which is everywhere in the room. I'm not seeing that in the lungs, and he would have had to have inhaled that for a period. So the obvious conclusion at this particular point is he was dead before the fire.
And we started the process of a homicide investigation.
Forensic pathologist Dr. David Fowler takes a closer look at the body of Stephen Rico to determine how he died before the fire began.
Okay, let's stop. Let's take a deep breath. Now what's going on? I don't have a cause of death now. I'm going to look at every one of his organs in detail. I'm going to take specimens to look at under a microscope. One considers everything.
We look at the body from head to toe because we're looking for signs of injury and we're looking for signs of disease. We want to see what's the internal trauma that may correspond to what we're seeing on the outside.
His heart was normal size, normal shape. There was absolutely no changes seen in the muscle fibers of the heart under a microscope. His blood vessels were all clean and open. He was a young man. He was very physically fit. There was really absolutely nothing that was identifiable from a potential natural disease process.
With no evidence of disease or cardiac arrest, Dr. Fowler orders more toxicology tests.
When the toxicology report came back to me, there was pesticide in his system.
Any pesticide could potentially kill you if it's a large enough dose or if it's administered in a way that it's not supposed to be.
Detectives wonder if pesticides somehow played a role in Stephen's death. They re-examine the timeline for clues.
Kim said Mike knew that Stephen and Kimberly's marriage was struggling, so he encouraged Stephen to bring her down for Valentine's Day and was able to help him get a room at that location.
Mike Miller was the golf course superintendent at Harbortown Resort.
Dr. Fowler informed us of pesticides in Stephen Rico's blood and in his tissue. And that caused a lot of concern for us.
As the resort's greenskeeper, Mike had unfettered access to large amounts of pesticides.
One of the main reasons why it's easier to poison someone that you know is that you have access to their things. You have an intimate knowledge of their whereabouts, so you're able to sneak the poison into certain places.
The reason why somebody would use poison is for some sort of secondary gain. First of all, they want to commit murder without being detected. But second of all, reap some sort of benefit from that murder.
Detectives re-interview Mike, hoping he might let slip a possible motive.
Mike was the one who set up the weekend at Harbortown for them. So we had to either implicate or eliminate Mike Miller as a part of the homicide investigation.
I remember being called down to the police barracks and sitting down and talking to them.
Police press Mike about the events leading up to the weekend of Stephen's death.
I had told him Steve had called and he was actually crying, which I had never in the entire time that I've known Steve known him to cry. And he was very upset that Kim had asked him for a divorce. After that initial conversation, If he called me again and said things were starting to look up, looking better, you know, they were working on a marriage. He had talked about maybe doing something for Valentine's Day. He said, you're always better at the romantic stuff than I ever was, so. I said, well, you know what? They're having this romantic getaway weekend at Harbor Town. You guys can have a nice weekend.
Investigators questioned Mike about his whereabouts the night of Stephen's death.
His alibi was that he was home with his wife and children in Easton. We were able to corroborate his story about being home that evening. Mike was devastated at the loss of his best friend, Stephen. But as he shared more, Mike quickly became an ally for police.
Just as police clear Miller, Dr. Fowler receives the results of the toxicology report.
After more analysis, the levels of the pesticides and the toxicology certainly were way outside the arena for a potential cause of death.
But the toxicology report does offer Detective Gamble a potential new lead.
We did find an antidepressant that was relatively new on the market and was not commonly used. And we did find an over-the-counter flu medication.
Stephen Rico had also been taking prescription muscle relaxants and anti-anxiety medication. Combined with alcohol, these drugs make for a powerful and often lethal cocktail.
Kimberly told us that Stephen Rico had too much to drink. Drugs and alcohol make people do stupid things.
There is one surprising thing missing from Dr. Fowler's toxicology report.
He had no alcohol in his system. And that was a shock. Because when I looked at the photographs at the scene, there were obviously alcohol bottles there. That made me take two steps backwards, and I had a moment of self-doubt and wondered whether or not I had mislabeled specimens. Fortunately, Mr. Rico's body was still at the medical examiner's office. It had not yet been claimed, so I went back to the body and resampled additional tissues and fluids to send to the toxicology laboratory. In the Rico case, we were looking for carbon monoxide, we were looking for the drugs that he'd been prescribed, or alcohol, and we were looking for toxins.
Forensic pathologists use a process called gas chromatography to detect substances in the blood of the deceased.
The sample vaporizes, and the small molecules can get through quickly, the big molecules come out slower. It was a little counter, and it counts each of the molecules as they come through, and the time it takes for them to get there is the size of the molecule. And from that, the toxicologist can make a determination as to the molecular weight and can tell you exactly what the substance is. And the height of those is the amount of substance that was coming out at that particular time based on these printouts. In the Rico case, said that he had no alcohol, but also no carbon monoxide. So all of the first specimens had been correct.
With the medical results at odds with the evidence at the crime scene, investigators dig deeper into the Ricos' lives. The police interview one of Kim's closest friends, Jennifer Gowan.
Jennifer gave an awful lot of information to the police. So it started to create a very clear picture of what was going on. Jennifer was getting married in November, 97. And she had a cousin, Brad Winkler. He was a Marine, and he came to some of the pre-wedding festivities. And Kimberly met Brad, and they developed a very intense relationship, and Kimberly confided in Jennifer that she was having a relationship with Brad Winkler.
He's a Marine officer. He's in shape. He's type A.
Investigators hone in on Brad. They wonder if he killed Stephen to have Kim all to himself.
In my experience as a homicide prosecutor, A lot of murders occur as a result of uncontrolled passions, love triangles, jealousy, revenge.
We really got to look at this guy. We got to look at him hard. He's a suspect now.
A secret love triangle could be the key in discovering the truth about Stephen Rico's death.
And our job as homicide investigators is to eliminate or implicate. There's only two options. We are very concerned that Brad's involved in this love triangle.
These people in the moment are absolutely consumed with passion and sex and the illusion of love, and they will do anything to be with that person.
Detective Gamble and I went to visit Brad Winkler. He confirmed what we already knew, that there was a relationship, an affair.
But Brad said he wasn't in this for some long-lasting relationship. This was strictly a sexual relationship for him, a relationship of convenience, if you will. And that became very clear very quickly. And we asked for his alibi.
He was on assignment in South Carolina that weekend. He was not around.
And then we're able to corroborate his alibis, where he is at specific times. And we were able to eliminate him pretty quickly.
With Brad cleared as a suspect and still no cause of death, the investigation stalls.
When you're at work on homicide, it's kind of like putting a jigsaw puzzle together, but you don't have the box. So you have all these pieces scattered everywhere, and you're finding pieces everywhere, and you're trying to put it together, but you don't have the box as a guide because you don't know what the picture is going to look like. It can be very frustrating.
The public wants answers, and they want a case solved very quickly. But the reality of many homicide investigations is that they take a long time. They require collaboration amongst many different parties, and oftentimes they're very difficult to solve.
Investigators hope Dr. Fowler will find a new lead in the charred remains of Stephen Rico.
This becomes a challenge. I have a responsibility, and so now the investigation goes on, and this is becoming much, much more complex. I spent time discussing the case with the chief medical examiner. We had weekly meetings where all of the medical examiners in the department would present their difficult and challenging cases to each other. We're trying to tie all of this together into some logical answer.
Refusing to let the case turn cold, investigators re-examine the scene to learn more about the role the fire played in the crime.
During the investigation, we worked closely with the state fire marshal's office. One of the questions that we had is, how did this fire start?
The fire marshal's office eliminates common causes of fire, like heating or electrical. They're left with a cigar.
So we went about to try to prove or disprove whether or not a fire could start from a cigar in the room.
Experts replicate the Valentine's Day fire using the same linens and cigars found in the cottage Stephen and Kim rented.
Harbortown was a commercial establishment. All their bed and linen have to meet code, so they're not supposed to be combustible. They have to have linens that are fire retardant.
The burn test is repeated several times. More smoldering cigars are added to see if the pillow will ignite.
The backwoods cigars, when ignited, did not light the pillowcase, which was the point of origin of this fire. In fact, a deputy from the Maryland Fire Marshal's office he even used three backwood cigars, smoldering, ignited, together on the pillow. And they just burned themselves out. They did not ignite the pillow.
Kim claimed that he was smoking. And I told him a time of all our life that I've known Steve, he's never smoked.
Investigators consider a different cause of the fire.
Most people use an accelerant, whether it's gasoline, lighter fluid, or something similar. Someone brought in a dog trained to sniff for accelerants. That dog alerted, positive for some type of accelerant in the room.
Detective Gamble and his team have caught their first big break.
And somebody has put some time into thought into staging this scene. Why do we have cigars when his friends are telling us he didn't smoke? Why are all these empty beer bottles in the room, yet his blood alcohol level doesn't show that? And then you compare it to the story of the person that was last in their presence, which in this case was Kimberly Rico, his wife.
Investigators take a hard look at Kim's version of events.
Kim is telling investigators that she didn't bring the cigars or the beer, that he must have brought the cigars and the beer with him in his luggage or in their car, that she didn't purchase them. At that point, the cigars become very important. The beer becomes very important. And on those cigars, there was a sticker with the price tag. It was $249 plus tax. So I went about attempting to figure out what stores had these.
Sergeant Gamble went to as many as 25 or so liquor stores in the area.
I found a store that had some Backwoods Smokes. It was a similar sticker with blue ink. And on that sticker, it said $2.99 plus tax. But there were two stickers over top of each other at an angle, so I could see there was another sticker on there. Underneath it was a $2.49 plus tax. The store had just raised the price.
Old-fashioned police work leads investigators to the source of the cigars. Now Detective Gamble must find out who purchased them.
Over the next 2 days, I met with every clerk and showed them six pictures, one including Stephen, another one, six pictures, one including Kimberly. One clerk pointed to Kim Rico's picture and said, I remember her because she bought a pack of cigars and some Budweiser. I said, why do you remember that? And he said, she came up in line. I asked her where she got her hair dyed, that pretty red color that it was. And Kim was offended and said, I don't dye my hair. This is my natural color. And that woman said, I'll never forget that woman, as nasty as she was to me.
The witness identification puts Kim in the store. It confirms she bought the exact same brand of beer and cigars found in the room where Stephen was killed.
And that was a huge piece of evidence to show that Kimberly was lying.
Detectives believe Kim staged the crime scene, but they still need a cause of death to move the investigation forward.
We excluded natural death. We excluded accident due to the fire. There was no trauma to the body other than the superficial burning. It was still a mystery.
Investigators suspect Kim Rico was involved in her husband's death, but without knowing how she killed him, they can't arrest her.
When a person commits a murder, one of the first things that they think about is, how am I going to get away with it? And fire, in its all-consuming power, becomes a way of destroying all evidence. It's also very symbolic. It's a way of obliterating a person from existence.
At that point in the investigation, Kim had no idea that we knew about the carbon monoxide, that we knew about the cigars, that we knew about the beer, that we knew all those things. Because the contact we had with Kim, we were just trying to string her along until more information came from the medical examiner's office.
We were trying to determine why Stephen died. It wasn't smoke inhalation. It wasn't any blunt trauma. So why did he die?
We are weeks into the investigation. Mr. Rico's body has been claimed. It has been buried. We have already harvested all of the specimens that we need to do any additional tests. But at this stage, we still did not have a method by which he had died. So we kept on hunting.
While Dr. Fowler and his colleagues continue to probe for a viable cause of death, investigators cast the net wider on the Rico social circle.
They'll talk to friends, coworkers, and a range of other people. And so what we see is this kind of web of social relationships that the investigator will look into to see if there are possible leads into the person's death.
Initially, when we confronted any of those folks, they were very standoffish. Why were we dragging this thing out? This was a horrible accident.
I was spending time at Kim's house. So I called Mike and I asked if I could stay for a day or two until we could get Kim settled. And Mike started questioning what had happened and told me over the phone that there was no question in his mind that Kim was involved in Steve's death. You just can't expect to believe that when your best friend supposedly has done something so horrific. He said, "Maureen, there's just something wrong. There's everything does not add up. There's something wrong."
In a small town, rumors that something is not right spread quickly. They travel across the bay, reaching Kim's old college roommate in Baltimore.
Rachel was living close by, so I reached out to her and I said, "Can you come over and help?" And there was this long, pregnant pause. And she goes, "Nope, I'm not coming over."
Instead, Rachel goes to the police.
Kimberly told Rachel that she had to get rid of Stephen. She had a plan as to how to do it. That she had access to a drug that could not be detected. And she described this to Rachel one evening. Rachel was concerned, but Kimberly had been drinking. She thought it was alcohol talking. So the investigation took a sudden and dramatic turn.
Detectives informed Dr. Fowler of their newest lead.
The police phoned me up and said, "Kim works in the operating room, the hospital. What substances would she potentially have access to that we would not be able to trace?" Immediately, my medical background kicks into high gear and goes, "Well, I have a sneaking suspicion I know what's in that operating room in the way of anesthetic drugs. And I know that we can find all of them in a body except one. And the one substance we can't find is succinylcholine. Succinylcholine is a short-acting, paralyzing agent. And when you inject it into somebody, all their muscles are paralyzed. And therefore, they can't breathe because they can't move their chest muscles or their diaphragm."
Poison is a methodology that many women prefer to use, because it overcomes physical size differences. It's a clandestine or secretive method. It allows a person to kill another person without having to physically overpower them.
Investigators suspect Kim Rico stole drugs from the hospital and used them to kill her husband. They set about finding physical proof.
So we went to Holy Cross Hospital. I interviewed a number of her coworkers there.
There is a coworker at the hospital, Kenneth Burgess. He had some legal difficulties in the past. And perhaps that's what led Kimberly to approach him.
He reluctantly told us a story where Kim had approached him and said, hey, Ken, how much would you charge to kill my husband? And Ken laughed it off, thought it was a joke. And he says, just stick him with some succinylcholine and put him to sleep forever. We knew that Ken was the key piece of evidence that we needed. I knew immediately that we needed Ken to have a conversation with Kimberly on the telephone to confront her with this.
Detectives set a trap for Kim, using her friend Ken as bait.
Ken started the conversation with, hey, I'm really sorry about what you're going through, with Steven. And then we kind of steered Ken into the whole conversation where Kimberly approached him about killing him for money. You could tell she became nervous on the other end of the phone. She started questioning him, like, you know I was kidding, right? You understand that, Ken, right? That was just a joke. But he started pushing him a little bit. And that's when she kind of dropped her guard. She confirmed Ken's conversation about killing the husband for money. But what she told Ken at the end was, you gave me some really good advice that day. The advice was, inject him with succinylcholine and put him to sleep forever.
Evidence is mounting against Kim Rico in the brutal death of her husband, but investigators still need more to convince a jury.
We went to get an arrest warrant for her. At the same time, we get a phone call from the emergency dispatchers that they're dispatching an ambulance, that she'd attempted suicide.
I went to the hospital, and at that point, she realizes that she is in trouble and that she needs legal counsel. And she was crying and she was panicked. I sat on the bed and was trying to calm her down. And that's when she told me she did it. I think that it was too much for her and she just let it out. I leaned forward to her on the bed and said, "What did you just say?" And right then her lawyer came in the room and that wall went back up and she shut up and I left. And I never talked to her again.
We got an arrest warrant, and we charged her while she was at the hospital.
The hospital bed confession is the only time Kim Rico admitted to killing Steven, but her motive for murder soon becomes clear.
When we did the search warrant of Kim's house, we found a life insurance policy that she took out on him.
Divorce requires time, money, patience, and I think we see with murderers who eliminate their spouse in their thinking it's going to be the quicker, faster route.
Investigators and the medical examiner have found the key to unlocking the mystery of Steven Rico's horrific death.
Kimberly Rico had taken off work the day before they left to come to the Eastern Shore. That's the day she went into the liquor store, bought the cigars, bought the beer. She brought all that down to Harbortown Resort. They got back to the room that night. She probably seduced him. She injected him with succinylcholine when they were intimate. She watched him die. It was clear to us that Kimberly had committed this crime. Our fear was that we wouldn't be able to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt in front of a jury.
Kimberly Rico's murder trial begins in January 1999. Dr. Fowler explains his theory of Stephen's murder to the jury.
Succinylcholine breaks down in the human body very, very rapidly, within a few minutes, into two substances which are naturally occurring within the body. You have enzymes in your bloodstream that have the ability to break this molecule up and destroy it. It only acts for 4 to 8 minutes in most circumstances. So we can't tell when we look at a person whether or not the substances that we've found came from an injection or whether they're just normally occurring. We knew he was dead before the fire. There was a witness who stated she was going to kill her husband using a substance we couldn't trace. We knew she had access to it. All of these little pieces tied together.
They found her guilty of first-degree arson and first-degree murder.
Dreams of a comfortable life with a new lover push this black widow to commit the ultimate betrayal.
A jury believed that it was succinylcholine. I believed it was succinylcholine. But we were never able to prove that through physical evidence in his body. But when you put that jigsaw puzzle together, it can be missing a couple pieces at the end, and you can still see that picture as Kim Rico.
Kim Rico is sentenced to life in prison.
I realized, all adding up, I was stupid fool. I'd been defending her and ignored the signs that something was wrong.
Our youngest is actually named after Steve, her name's Stephanie. And then I just asked, you know, can we honor Steve in some way? And so the closest thing we could come up to Stephen was Stephanie. And as she was growing up, we called her Stevie.
It just really is just a great example of unraveling a very complex case, one thread at a time. We are not there to assist the prosecution. We're not there to assist the defense. We are there to provide the jury with as an accurate set of facts as possible. We're there for the truth. Present it and let's see what the cards fall.